Welcome, and thank you for standing by. I would like to inform all participants that your lines have been placed on a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's call. Today's call is being recorded. If anyone has any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Dr. Cunningham. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everyone. We're going to begin our open meeting for the fall, which is scheduled a little ahead of time in October, when we usually have it. Our first presentation will be the draft policy for magnetic resonance image-guided high-intensity focused ultrasound for tremor. Dr. Howe?
Thank you, Dr. Cunningham, and good afternoon. We added tremor-dominant Parkinson's disease, or TDPD, to the existing MR-guided focused ultrasound LCD based on a new published RCT, and subsequent FDA label expansion. The criteria you see here reflect both the FDA label and manufacturer's requested language. By way of some background, tremor is a common motor feature of Parkinson's disease, and TDPD is a clinical subtype distinct from akinesia, rigidity, and postural instability gait disorder subtypes. And also, this tremor-dominant subtype may be more resistant to dopamine replacement therapy than other motor symptoms. I mentioned the published RCT. That's the Bond study cited at the bottom of the slide. This is a small prospective sham-controlled trial published in 2017, and it demonstrated statistically significant improvement in hand tremor in these tremor-dominant PD patients at 3 and 12 months. This was followed, as I mentioned, in 2018 by expansion of the FDA indication to include TDPD with medication or full medication refractory tremor patients. As with essential tremor, MR-guided focused ultrasound is considered an alternative when not a surgical candidate for deep brain stimulation. We received no presentation for this policy. Operator, do we have any comments on this policy? Operator, could you hear me?
I do apologize. What was your question?
We received no presentations for this policy ahead of time, but I wanted to ask if there are any comments on this policy on the people that have dialed in.
Sure. If you would like to ask a question on the policy, please press star one. Again, that's star one if you would like to ask a question. One moment. We do have a question. One moment. Our first question comes from Eric Grayling. Your line is open.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Eric, good morning to some. I apologize. This is not a question about that specific LCD, but rather, are there known issues right now with respect to the WebEx? It's not coming up on my computers.
There's no known issues that I've heard of. I do see people in WebEx, so I believe it's functioning properly.
Dr. Grayling, did you register for the WebEx?
I sure did. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. Did you get a confirmation email?
I did, yes.
So, yeah, so if you select join event and that's not working for you.
Correct. I'll get by just with the audio, but I appreciate it, and I'm sorry to have to interrupt the meeting like that.
We can certainly send you the slides through email if that would help you.
Much appreciated. Thank you.
Sure.
Operator, are there any other questions?
There are not.
Okay. Thank you. Then the comments on this policy for this open meeting are now closed. The next policy on the agenda is colon capsule endoscopy, or CCE. Next slide, please. Colon capsule endoscopy, or CCE, involves a wireless camera housed in a vitamin-sized capsule that is swallowed, and then it takes pictures as it travels down the GI tract. The pictures are transmitted to a recorder worn by the patient and then subsequently strung together to create a video. The evidence, the published evidence, supports the request that we received that CCE may be a suitable alternative to optical colonoscopy or CT colonography in a very select group of patients for whom a diagnostic optical colonoscopy for suspected polyps was either unsuccessful or relatively contraindicated. Next slide. This slide details the draft criteria for either surveillance or diagnostic CCE in the setting of either an incomplete optical colonoscopy or when optical colonoscopy is contraindicated, and are based largely on the FDA-approved indications. Next slide. Exclusion criteria mostly reflect the manufacturer's generic pill cam limitations, like GI obstruction, cardiac pacemaker, swallowing disorder, et cetera, but also emphasize that CCE for colorectal cancer screening is not a Medicare benefit, regardless of family history or other risk factors. We did receive one submitted comment on this policy, and operator, if you could see if Dr. Bergwerk, his line is open to comment, if he's there. Dr. Bergwerk, can you hear me? Can you speak?
Dr. Bergwerk, if you are on the line, please press star zero. One moment. Dr. Bergwerk's line is open.
Hello.
Good afternoon, Dr. Bergwerk.
Hi,
we can hear you.
Can you hear me well?
Yep. Please proceed.
Excellent. Hi. My name is Ari Bergwerk. I'm a physician. I'm a pediatric gastroenterologist. I work part-time in practice and part-time as a medical advisor at Medtronic. Thank you for allowing me to present at this meeting. I believe you received the presentation. Can you advance the slide?
Yeah, operator, advance one more, please.
Thank you. Good. I'd like to thank you for inviting me to present, we appreciate the effort that went into the panel's development of the proposed LCD colon capsule endoscopy. In particular, NGS recognizes that PILCAN colon 2 qualifies for Medicare coverage as a diagnostic test and is safe and effective, as well as reasonable and necessary for a defined patient's population. The proposed LCD indicates that colon capsule endoscopy is not a Medicare benefit for colorectal cancer screening, regardless of family history, early risk factors for development of chronic disease. And Medtronic supports this limitation since PILCAN colon 2 is not FDA cleared for colorectal cancer screening. And Medtronic respectfully requests NGS to move forward with coverage for colon capsule endoscopy based upon the FDA approved indications, which are two. One, it may be used for detection of colon polyps in patients after incomplete conventional colonoscopy with adequate preparation, and a complete evaluation of the colon was not technically feasible. And two, for detection of colon polyps in patients with evidence of lower GI bleeding, this applies only to patients with major risks for colonoscopy, such as for moderate sedation, but who could tolerate colonoscopy with sedation or anesthesia in the event that a clinically significant colonic abnormality was found at capsule endoscopy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Bergwerk.
Sure.
Operator, can you see if there are any other comments online on this policy?
Thank you. As a reminder, if you'd like to make a comment, please press star 1. Again, that's star 1 if you'd like to make a comment. And at this time, we have no one looking to ask a comment.
Thank you, Operator. And at this time, the comments on this policy for this open meeting are now closed. Sorry, back to you, Dr. Cunningham.
Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. Next is select minimally invasive GERD procedures. And Dr. Bourne will be presenting.
Thank you. This was a request to update our LCD on select minimal invasive GERD procedures. We were asked to include Streta. We evaluated a number of papers we received. There were 43 of them. 13 had been previously evaluated by NGS and been included in bibliography, so they did not add any new support for Streta. There were 8 that were considered to be positive coverage documents by the submitter. None of them were from Medicare contractors, but rather commercial insurance plans, which use contract language as part of the decision-making process rather than evidence-based method that Medicare requires. Thus, none of these added any support to Streta. Many of the remaining 22 articles were old. Others were small studies or had short follow-up periods. Many pertained to patients who were not reflective of typical Medicare beneficiaries. The methodological quality and design of the studies were, most of them were poor. Some were unpublished or not found in PubMed of the National Library of Congress and the National Center for Biotech Information. A 44th article review from Cochrane Base was mentioned by one of the submitted articles. It was mentioned and reviewed, and that article with very strong evidence against Streta. Do we have any presenters? Do we have any people on the lines who have comments on this also?
As a reminder, if you'd like to make a comment, please press star 1.
Okay, if there are no people making comments, we will close this one policy. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Next is heavy metal testing, and Dr. Bourne will present this too.
Thank you. We were asked to add zinc testing for the diagnosis of depression to our heavy metal testing. Zinc deficiency is characterized by growth retardation, loss of appetite, and impaired immune function, as well as hair loss, diarrhea, impotence, hypogonadism in males, eye and skin lesion, weight loss, delayed healing of wounds, and taste abnormality in more severe case. Zinc nutritional status is difficult to measure adequately using laboratory tests. Plasma or serum zinc levels are most commonly used indices for evaluating zinc deficiency, but these levels do not necessarily reflect cellular zinc status. It's been suggested that zinc and other micronutrients might influence depression. A recent meta-analysis assessing the relationship between zinc deficiency and depression concluded there is insufficient evidence demonstrating a causal effect. Furthermore, the authors noted that the relationship between serum zinc levels and depression could partially be explained by reversible causation, where depression influences the intake, bioavailability, or the biological regulation of zinc. Therefore, zinc assessment and supplementation for the treatment of depression is not considered to be medically necessary. Do we have any presenters on this? Operator, do we have anyone on the line who wishes to comment on this?
As a reminder, if you'd like to make a comment, please press star 1.
Well, if there aren't any comments, this concludes the discussion presentation for heavy metal testing. I will refer back to Dr. Cunningham.
Thank you, Steve. The next and last policy is to set joint interventions for pain management. Dr. Durden?
Thank you, Dr. Cunningham. If you go to the first slide, this is a reminder to those that are going to be presenting and or commenting for this LCD. We need to have written comments regarding your presentations today and such that so that they, I recognize there will be verbal comments made, but we appreciate and we will only be considering written communications. Now, if you can go to the first slide, this entire LCD has been reformatted following the 21st Century Cures Act format and with a recent assessment of the evidence-based medical standards that are present. This was augmented by a multi-jurisdictional CAC meeting that was held in May 28, 2020, where all the noted Medicare administrative contractors were present, as well as the group of 10 subject matter experts. You can go to the next slide. Because facet joint interventions for pain are known to be rather challenging due to the variability of the medical literature, the lack of consensus among even the experts, and the differences in the societal guidelines and the historical patterns that are done in the community, this demonstrates that there is a high risk for overutilization. Therefore, it was felt that a clearer understanding of facet guidelines was necessary. Therefore, because of this, we have used the best available evidence that has been determined, and we have been able to facilitate that and supplement that with the subject matter experts that were held at that multi-jurisdictional CAC. If you can go to the slide for definitions. Just briefly, I want to touch on some of the definitions that are going to be used in this presentation. The first is there's an abbreviation IA, and that's intra-articular facet joint injections. MBB is medial branch facet blocks. RFA, radio frequency facet ablation, also known as facet joint deinnervation. And then something that is important to recognize is the term spine region, because there's going to be two spine regions that will be defined in this policy. That is the cervical thoracic region and the lumbar sacral region. If you can go to the next slide, please. The first discussion I would like to have is the discussion about diagnostic facet procedures. This diagnostic facet procedure, whether it's a medial branch block or an intra-articular facet joint injection, the primary objective is to confirm the diagnosis of facet joint syndrome. That's very important and why this policy needed to have some updating to really help facilitate that, to help our practitioners, our physicians that are doing these procedures, that they're going to use this as a way to diagnose facet joint syndrome. Because if that is positive, the goal is actually to proceed to the radiofrequency ablation procedure, and that is the primary treatment goal that is found to be I recognized in the medical literature as the end goal. In order to be considered positive response, this article clarifies, and this is actually not much of a change from prior LCDs, that there must be at least 80% of relief of the primary index pain, the pain that they had just prior to the injection, and that'll be based on the duration of whatever agent was used in that procedure, since many people use different things. Also, another aspect is that there needs to be at least 50% consistent objective improvement in the ability of the individuals to perform painful movements or activities of daily living. And this would be over a period of time that is outlined in the LCD. If you go to the next slide, I wanted to clarify a second point regarding the diagnostic facet joint procedures, and that is that after the initial facet joint injection is done, we recognize that a need, and the medical literature recognizes the need, that a second diagnostic facet procedure is medically necessary so you can confirm the validity of that initial diagnostic facet joint procedure, so that needs to be documented as being done at the same level as the initial procedure and have the same consistent positive responses that were defined in the previous slide. Also new to this policy is that in most cases, we recognize that there will be two initial diagnostic injections. This policy allows a maximum of 4 diagnostic injections per rolling 12 months so that the identification and assessment of a pain generator can be provided, because sometimes it is possible that when an initial injection was done, that the one or two levels that were injected were not the exact pain generators, so additional diagnostic procedures may be necessary, and we recognize that. Also new to this policy is the billing with the KX modifier, so we can distinguish a diagnostic injection when it is performed. Now, if you can go to the next slide. And that slide is regarding the therapeutic facet joint procedures. As I pointed out at the very beginning of the discussion, the therapeutic facet joint procedures are going to be limited because the intent is to get the individuals, the patients, the beneficiaries, to the radiofrequency ablation procedure. So if you have a therapeutic facet injection, then you're not actually going to try to get to that RFA procedure. Therefore, we recognize that there is, and the medical literature recognizes, that there is a need first to document why the beneficiary may not be proceeding to get an RFA procedure. But then there's also a limit in the number of therapeutic facet injections that are going to be provided, and that is 4 therapeutic injections sessions per spine region. And those will be reimbursed at a rolling 12-month interval. You go to the next slide. So it is the when it comes to radio frequency facet injections, then the beneficiary needs to have sufficient documentation to show that the radiofrequency procedure provided consistent and objective 50% improvement in the pain for at least 6 months before a second RFA procedure will be covered. The limitation, therefore, for the radiofrequency injections are going to be per each covered spinal region, no more than 2 radiofrequency sessions will be reimbursed for each 12 rolling 12 months. Go to the next slide. I'd like to just touch briefly upon the facet cyst aspiration components. This is a rare thing, but it does occur, and therefore we included this in the facet policy. And this, when a cyst is to be injected and treated, it needs to have two particular inclusion criteria. First, there has to be the use of the diagnostic imaging study and clinical evidence to show the corresponding nerve root of the facet joint has been impaired. And we have to have clinical and physical symptoms related to that synovial facet cyst, and those need to be documented. When those two indications are met, the cyst aspiration can be repeated once and only if there's 50% or more improvements, and that can be done at least every 3 months. Now, if you go to the next slide, and these are just, I'll just touch briefly on them. This facet joint LCD is going to have some particular key limitations and guidelines to indicate how these procedures need to be performed. We're requiring imaging. We are not going to allow general anesthesia or sedation, since it is general societal guidelines as well as the consensus guidelines of our CAC members that routine sedation for facet joints are not needed. One or two levels, either unilateral or bilateral, will be allowed per session, per spine region. And the retreatment of those can be done without repeat diagnostic blocks if the treatments are within the past 24 months. And then also just briefly touching again on the therapeutic injections, these are not covered unless there is justification in the medical documentation, particularly why a radiofrequency ablation procedure cannot be performed. Now, if you go to the last slide. In this LCD, it also indicates that facet joint procedures in individuals with generalized pain conditions, such as fibromyalgia or other chronic centralized pain syndromes, are not is not considered reasonable and necessary, but may be considered on appeal. And then finally, it is not expected that these patients will routinely present with the specific pain in a particular facet joint they will not need multiple facet blocks on the same day as an injection, i.e. such as a trigger point injections, epidural injections, et cetera. There is not expected that these individuals, beneficiaries, will need three levels procedures. One or two level facet joint injections will be considered reasonable and necessary. And also the routine performance of repetitive injections will trigger a focused medical review. And I know there are at least two presenters. I don't have their order. So, operator, I will turn the time over to you and Dr. Cunningham to determine who's going to be our first presenter.
I think Dr. Desai is listed as the first presenter. Are you with us, Dr. Okay. Desai?
Yeah, Dr. Cunningham, our presenters for this policy were expecting it to come up around 2 p.m., so it's possible that some of them are not online yet. Maybe Dr. Garibo was one, Dr. Desai and Dr. Stout. Maybe if any of those presenters are here, we could start with one of them.
I do have Dr. Garibo on. Your line is open, doctor.
Hi. Thank you for the invitation. I would like to – I just want to be able to see my slides. I'm sorry. Okay, great. Thank you. So I am Dr. Christopher Garibo. I'm the medical director of pain medicine at NYU Langone Health. I put together this presentation in collaboration with Dr. Sanjay Bakhti, who's with Ortho Manhattan in New York City as well, and in collaboration with our other colleagues through New York State Society of Interventional Pain Physicians. Next slide, please. There's no relevant conflict of interest for Dr. Bakhti and myself. Next slide, please. Now, with respect to the diagnostic determination of the success of a facet medial branch block, I would like to emphasize that the pain world is clearly moving towards functional restoration rather than percent pain reduction. And I think for best clinical outcomes and for best specificity and sensitivity, we need to have both available to us, and the designation should be a specific percent pain reduction of, let's say, 80%, which we would agree with, or a functional restoration of something that was prior more and that was painful to begin with before the medial branch block that can be assessed during the duration of the local anesthetic. And the reason to keep it or is extremely important is because there are many of our patients that don't have a good concept of percentages, percent pain reduction, or even numerical pain intensity. They describe their pain in terms of limitations of range of motion, sitting intolerance or standing intolerance, or even this is a pain provocation that can be measured in terms of the lumbar range of motion, and that can be assessed immediately after the performance of the medial branch block. So moving towards functional restoration is also in line with, for example, FDA goals in terms of analgesic outcomes, focusing more on function rather than pain reduction and visual analog scale scores, as well as other parallel coverage determinations that apply to epidurals, other clinical studies that are being performed that are based on treatment of chronic pain conditions. Next slide, please. So there are multiple reasons to not rely on the local anesthetic percent pain reduction and focus more on function. And I think us as a clinical advisors encourage you to move in that direction because false positives can occur due to local paraspinal muscular effect, local or systemic absorption, proximal dorsal ramus local anesthetic effect, and blockade of the dorsal root ganglion blockade, or the patient's simple miscomprehension of the percent pain reduction where they get things totally reversed. False negatives can occur where patient, let's say, gives us a 40% pain reduction, but their range of motion is now full during the duration of the local anesthetics, whereas prior it was limited to about 10-20%. And now they're able to sit for a prolonged period of time beyond, let's say, 15 minutes, whereas prior they were not able to do that at all. They were able to sit, for example, in the recovery area after the nerve block for a 30-45-minute duration. So therefore, we are certainly in agreement with the OR designation between 80% reduction in the pain or at least 50% consistent objective improvement in the ability to perform previously painful movements, ranges of motion, and activities of daily living. Next slide, please. So in addition to that all imperative OR between percent pain reduction and functional improvement, we would also would like to emphasize that the second diagnostic block can be separated from the first diagnostic block after some minimum and significant healing has occurred. And that minimum time frame can be a week. By a week time frame, any muscle damage, any bleeding, any soft tissue or skin pain that is occurring has pretty much resolved. And the patient can be retested for the second medial branch block in a week time, but not any sooner than that. With respect to a repeat radiofrequency procedure, our society believes, and Dr. Bakshi and myself believe, that a repeat medial branch block is necessary before we perform another neurodestructive procedure, such as a radiofrequency ablation. And the reason behind that being simply because low back pain, although it may appear to be the same, it has a whole range of different etiological factors that are just very difficult to ascertain and pin down in the clinical exam, that we should not move based on an assumption, but we should move based on objective, repeatable data at the time of the pain recurrence, and the repeat medial branch blocks can be repeated at that time. And the last comments I want to make is that these injections are performed, generally speaking, under fluoroscopy, not so much under CAT scan or MRI. I don't know if I put that point out of context on that slide, as well as another point being that there is a subset of patients, although the majority of patients are going to require one or two-level facet, there is a very small subset that is going to require three-level facet denervation on one side, for example. And it's the incidence of that is probably 10, 15, 20% or so, if that. But these patients tend to have a multi-level facet disease, and in a very small subset that may involve three separate facet nerve blocks and radiofrequency ablation. Thank you for this opportunity, and I'm happy to take any questions, and I believe Dr. Bakshi is on the line as well.
As a reminder, if you'd like to make a comment, please press star 1. At this time, we have no comments.
Operator, can you place the second presenter on the phone, please?
Dr. Desai, if you're on the line, please press star 0. I do not believe he's dialed in yet.
And operator, I would like to then open up the line to anyone else who would like to make a comment.
Mark, did you want to check and see if Dr. Stout is on?
Oh. I apologize.
Well, Dr. Stout did say she would not be available till 2 o'clock, but maybe, you know, the operator can still try.
And Dr. Stout, if you are on the line, please press star 0. At this time, neither are on the phone line, but if you are Dr. Stout or Desai, please press star 0. We do have someone who'd like to make a comment or question. Would you like to go to that?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Eric, your line is open.
Yes, hi. Thank you very much. This is Eric Grayling. I'm a pain management physician in Central Connecticut. I'm the president of the Connecticut Pain Society, and I am the Connecticut representative for pain management to the CAC. I appreciate everyone's effort and time and being here addressing this very, very important discussion. I have no relevant conflicts of interest. I work in a solo private practice office, and I spend a great deal of time helping people with facet joint pain. The goals of which are to restore one's mobility and functionality, decrease the need for other interventions, and decrease the need for medications, which in many beneficiaries, there are various side effects which aren't tolerated in an older patient population. And additionally, in light of the ongoing opioid epidemic, which we're dealing with here in Connecticut and I'm sure every other state, we want to minimize the usage of the medications, which in chronic pain, have equivocal evidence in terms of the efficacy and in terms of relief and of the pain and as well as functionality. I do have some concerns, and I speak on behalf of the Connecticut Pain Society regarding the presentation and the draft LCD, mainly in terms of limitations. For instance, on the presentation that was just made regarding, I have page 21 or slide 21, facet joint denervation. This addresses the frequency limitation. The third bullet point, and I'll read this, frequency limitation, for each covered spinal region, no more than 2 radio frequency sessions will be reimbursed per rolling 12 months. This needs to be there needs to be clarification because many of us, including myself, for radio frequency ablations, we do one side at a time. So maybe left side and then the following week right side, and there are different reasons for that. But that being said, if we do that in this case. Generally, the standard of care is radiofrequency ablation shouldn't be performed any more frequently than 6 months per level per side. So if we look at as written here, this is of concern because if I were to do a two-level lumbar radiofrequency lesioning on the left and then one on the right, that beneficiary, as per this statement, would only be eligible for one treatment per 12 months. And that would run into major issues because oftentimes the radiofrequency treatment will only last 6 months, 9 months. And so the question is, what do we do with these patients who have responded very favorably to a very, very safe, non-surgical intervention? What do we do if they aren't getting sustained relief for 1 year? So that's an issue. And additionally, as the doctor from New York pointed out, limiting the levels to one or two level lesioning is of concern because there is and it's a minority, but there is a significant percentage of patients who have three and sometimes even four level facet joint mediated pain, and that's proven by a diagnostic medial branch nerve blocks under fluoroscopy. And so the question arises as to what we do with the patients whereby, we do the radiofrequency lesioning, they're, say, 50% improved, their functionality is improved, yet they're still having to rely upon Vicodin or an opioid to help manage the other 50% of their pain, which arguably could be eradicated by ablating a couple of more facet joint levels. So that's a consideration we need to be mindful of. And in the LCD draft regarding from the draft, not the presentation we were just shown, but the LCD draft under limitations number 6, it does say two levels joints, either unilateral or bilateral, and four joints. I apologize. That's the revision. Let me see this. Pardon me. Okay. The proposal under number 6 for limitations, one or two levels, either uni or bilateral, are allowed per session per spine region. The need for a three-level procedure may be considered under unique circumstances and with sufficient documentation of medical necessity on appeal. Our society is recommending the language, and obviously I'll put this in a written format, but that be revised. That it states that for, two joints for bilateral procedures and up to four joints for unilateral procedures are allowed per session per spine region. I will put this obviously in a letter and submit it humbly, but I thank everyone for their time, and of course I'm available to answer any questions and help in any way I can.
Thank you, Dr. Grayling. In addition to the submission of your recommendations, we would appreciate that to be accompanied with the appropriate literature to support those recommendations.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you. And we do have Dr. Stout on the line now. Would you like me to open her line?
Yes, please.
Excuse me, this is the operator. Would you like Dr. Stout's line open? She has called in.
Yes, please. If you could open up Dr. Stout's line, we would appreciate it.
Thank you. Dr. Stout, your line is open.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I'm Dr. Allison Stout. I'm a physiatrist practicing in Washington State. I am here representing the Spine Intervention Society. These slides were put together by the Health Policy Division and do represent the views of the Spine Intervention Society as a whole. I want to thank everybody for having the opportunity to present this. Just for a little background, I'm in Washington State, which is under Noridian, which our LCD looks much like this proposed LCD, and so I'm quite familiar with practicing under it. I'll have a few personal comments of my own, and I'll disclose that those are my own personal comments when I get to those. Next slide, please. I have no relevant disclosures. Next slide, please. So looking at the proposed LCD, when looking at diagnostic facet joint procedures, we do, SAS does strongly agree with requiring a second diagnostic facet procedure to confirm the validity of the initial diagnostic facet procedure. On that same point, though, we feel that the second diagnostic procedure does not really need to be delayed for 2 weeks. Outside of any global periods, you know, that are required between facet procedures, 2 weeks seems to not have a medical basis. My suspicion, my personal suspicion, is that was carried over from epidural steroid literature, and that has, you know, with the repeated steroid injections are recommended to be 2 weeks apart. So SAS is recommending 48 hours after the diagnostic procedure. They could consider having a second because we're really just looking at the anesthetic phase relief. This is important, at least in my center, where we do have patients that will often travel from great distances and plan to spend, say, you know, a week to get to an answer, at least, of what their options for treatments would be and whether or not even if they're candidate for radiofrequency neurotomy. And so that sort of two-week delay could create quite a burden on patients that are traveling to treatment centers. Next slide, please. Criteria for second diagnostic facet procedure, yes, obviously we agree they should meet the criteria for the first diagnostic procedure, and that it should be of at least 80% relief of their index pain, with the duration of relief being consistent with the anesthetic used. Part about 50% consistent objective improvement in the ability to perform previously painful movements in ADLs is a nice consideration. There are many patients who have problems with a VAS score, have trouble separating out numbers for pain scores, and functional measures are good. However, this leaves a lot of vagueness. How do you measure this? How do you quantify this reliably? There's some risk of overutilization with that. This is where I'm going to bring in my personal experience. It's going to create a problem with any audits that are performed. We're a large center that gets referred a lot of radiofrequency treatments. We were audited, and under Noridian, there was the qualification of adequate physical therapy / conservative care, but that was never initially. That wasn't defined, and with a lot of back and forth, came up with 8 visits of physical therapy, whether that's, you know, valid scientifically or not, but that was what was decided, which at least gave us a clear thing to be able to use clinically. So that's just a side point there about the functional measures. Next slide, please. So therapeutic facet joint procedures, SIS feels that requiring 2 diagnostic Mio branch blocks prior to a therapeutic intra-articular injection is unreasonable and really not necessary. And this is because an intra-articular injection, at least historically, is often done with local anesthetic and steroid, and therefore considered both diagnostic and therapeutic at the same time. And since there's a percentage of patients that will obtain relief from a single intra-articular steroid injection, in select patients, that this, by combining the anesthetic and the steroid, this could result in significant cost savings over the 3-step needed to perform radiofrequency neurotomy. Next step, Next slide, please. For therapeutic facet joint procedures, SIS strongly believes that medial branch blocks are diagnostic procedures only and should only use local anesthetic. These are not considered therapeutic procedures. The idea of putting steroid along the medial branch nerves does not have any construct validity. There's not really there's no documentation of an inflammatory medial branch neuritis as a cause of this type of pain. So we stand that medial branch blocks should remain as diagnostic only rather than therapeutic. And again, bringing up the criteria of 50% consistent improvement in movements or ADLs, again, the vagueness of that could create some problems or difficulties managing these claims. Next slide, please. Therapeutic facet joint procedures. Under this, if a patient obtains at least 50% relief from a therapeutic facet joint injection, it seems unnecessary to require that they are not a candidate for radiofrequency neurotomy, meaning, you know, especially if we allow the use of intra-articular anesthetic and steroid injection of a facet, that could conceivably the initial treatment inappropriate to repeat in patients that improve from that by at least 50% for 3 months. And then if they didn't receive relief from that for 3 months, then they could go on to diagnostic medial branch block and then go on, if appropriate, to RF. And that would save steps for the patients as well as create a cost savings, especially for those patients that do respond to the intra-articular steroid portion. Next slide, please. So for the radiofrequency neurotomy portion of the proposed LCD, yes, we agree that they should have two diagnostic medial branch blocks or intra-articular diagnostic blocks that result in at least 80% relief of their index pain, consistent with the duration of the anesthetic. And again, same point about the 50% improvement in movements and ADLs. Next slide, please. Some limitations on the radiofrequency proposed LCD. Repeating medial branch blocks after 24 months of pain relief or greater from radiofrequency neurotomy is not really necessary. If patients have experienced more than 24 months of relief from a radiofrequency neurotomy, and this does occur, a repeat procedure should be permitted at the same level to reinstate relief. You know, rather than requiring another two sets of medial branch blocks, which is again more cost and obviously more burden to the patient. You know, a potential alternative would be maybe a visit documenting that the pain is in the same location, or a pain diagram of the patients that documents it is in the same location. Understanding that 2 years is a long time to be able to say it's the exact same pain just over the phone for some patients. But it seems like it's going to result in more patient burden and higher cost to require two sets of medial branch blocks to repeat something that appears to be the exact same pain generator. There is also an area of inconsistency with Statement 6 in the list of procedures considered not reasonable and necessary and that will be denied, and that's diagnostic injections or MBBs at the same level as a previous successful RFN procedure. I think this is just a wording thing. I don't think that's the intention of the proposed LCD. It could be, the way it's written could be mistaken to say that somebody who had 24 months of relief cannot have a repeat RF and cannot have a repeat medial branch. So we're suggesting a wording change there. Next slide, please. Requiring documentation of why radiofrequency neurotomy should not be performed in patients being treated with therapeutic intra-articular facet injections does create unnecessary work for the physician that will not result in improved patient care. and I mentioned this before, so if we're allowing diagnostic intra-articular injections, you know, adding steroid to that to allow a diagnostic and therapeutic injection without someone technically being, quote, not a candidate for radiofrequency neurotomy could actually result in less treatment episodes and decreased cost, and, you know, for that one proportion of patients that get better with intra-articular injection of steroid. Next slide, please. Under provider qualifications, SAS would like the consideration for placing healthcare professionals with physicians. The reason for that is because of patient selection is actually pretty difficult in these cases. We think it'll actually result in overutilization if this is opened to, say, naturopaths and PAs, and assuming also, you know, chiropractors or healthcare professionals, that inability to really select patients based on known anatomy and prevalence of the disease and other potential causes of the pain generators is an important consideration. The other point is that these are actually difficult procedures technically. Professor Nick Bogduck has done a lot of anatomical and clinical research on medial branch anatomy and radiofrequency neurotomy. You know, he says, you know, lumbar medial branch is the most difficult simple procedure that was ever dreamt up, because, you know, especially in the Medicare population, there is some very difficult anatomy and need a lot of experience to be able to address that, even just for the medial branch blocks. Not, and then even more so for a successful radiofrequency neurotomy that requires very precise placement and adequate treatment to result in pain relief for these subjects. And then, of course, dealing with any potential complications is an issue as well. Next slide, please. So that's the end of the SIS recommendations for changes. Obviously, this will be in the written comments as well. But if there are any questions that come up before then, Belinda, our Senior Director of Policy and Practice, can answer those questions, or I can answer any questions now if anybody has any. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Stout. Did Dr. Desai, was he able to join us?
Yes, one moment. Dr. Desai, your line is open.
Hi, good afternoon. Hi, this is Dr. Desai. So I have a very brief statement on behalf of the American Academy of Physical Medicine and Rehab. So I think generally speaking, we just wanted to make two comments. One, we echoed the comments of the prior speaker, Dr. Stout, with regards to the Spine Intervention Society and their comments. And generally speaking, we also wanted to express an appreciation for the opportunity both to comment on these on this LCD, but also with the general sort of spirit of the LCD, I think is in line with what we were hoping for, and the opportunity to both collaborate and communicate regarding next steps is something that we very much appreciate. So I wanted to just make that very brief statement.
Thank you, Dr. Desai. Operator, we'd like to turn the line over to any final commenters.
Thank you. And as a reminder, please press star followed by one if you'd like to make a comment. One moment, please.
Dr. Durden, Dr. Bourne here. Can I make two comments, two clarifications, please?
Certainly.
Naturopaths are not recognized by Medicare, so this is not an issue. And by national regulations, chiropractors can only perform three CPT codes, which are all chiropractic manipulations. So they would not be eligible either for this. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bourne.
This is Dr. Garibo. Can I make a comment?
Yes, sir. We'll open up your line.
Thank you. Dr. Chris Garibo, from New York City on behalf of American Society of Interventional Pain Physicians. I'd like to emphasize that baseline percent pain reduction and function-linked percent pain reduction is still percent pain reduction. And given we're moving more towards a functional restoration being our ultimate goal, that is a much more relevant metric that has also been looked at in studies as well. And 50% improvement in function being okay for repeat radiofrequency should also make it okay to proceed to radiofrequency after 50% improvement in function in function-based pain for the initial set of medial branch blocks that later proceeds on to medial branch block proceeding on to radiofrequency ablation. I'd like to, extremely important for the Medicare population is that there is a subset of patients where false negative results are being produced, especially in the elderly, because they cannot understand the concept of percent pain reduction. So it is essential for our aging population to get a functional assessment during the duration of the local anesthetic, whether if that's a positive facet loading that has later become a negative facet loading, or whatever that ADL limitation may be, to serve those patients with less mind-altering medicines, there needs to be a recognition of that false negative, and there needs to be recognition of functional restoration that is provided by these medial branch blocks, which they do provide, which they should go on to proceed with radiofrequency if there is 50% pain reduction during functional maneuvers. And furthermore, as far as the repeat radiofrequency goes, you know, 2 years out, location may very much be the same, and the diagrams may very much look the same. But I think we all know that there is a whole range of diagnoses that can cause same exact pattern of low back pain and referral patterns. And before a neurodestructive procedure is performed, at least a single medial branch block should be done before RFA. And the last comment is 48 hours is still soft tissue healing phase for repeat medial branch blocks, and that now we're going to reinsert our needles into and try to gauge an assessment whether if the second medial branch block is effective. So I think in order to improve the specificity and overall reliability of the repeat medial branch block, at least a week should be allowed to elapse.
Thank you, Dr. Grebo.
And we do have a
operator,
couple other
there...
comments on the phone.
Thank you. Go ahead and open them up one
you.
By one, please.
All right. The next comment is from Sanjay. You may go ahead.
Yeah, hi. This is Dr. Bakshi. I'm also on the American Society of Interventional Pain Management, and I think all the points so far have been excellent. I agree on all three points that Dr. Garibo just mentioned. I think, you know, 2 weeks for in between diagnostic blocks is a long time, but 48 hours may be too short. So I think a week is a good timeline between the, you know, between the two diagnostic procedures. And also the point about, you know, judging the functional capacity as well as, you know, repeat medial branch block after 2 years. I think all those three I agree with completely. So those are my comments.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. The next comment is from Eric Grayling. You may go ahead.
Thank you. It's very good presentations. I am very much supportive of Dr. Stout's recommendation regarding healthcare professionals being switch to physicians. I know in my area there are several non-physicians who are, and I can't speak to whether or not there's our Medicare beneficiaries, but there are chiropractors that are doing under ultrasound facet blocks and billing them out as such, and unfortunately I've seen that. I do have to say on behalf of the American Society of Interventional Pain Physicians, ACIP, that there is some evidence to show that medial branch nerve blocks can be therapeutic, and I will submit those studies to you all for your review. And additionally, the concept of an intra-articular facet joint injection being diagnostic is a very controversial concept, I know when we had our expert meeting back in May, we all voted on that, and I don't believe that there was high confidence in the intra-articular facet injection as being a truly diagnostic testing modality. And I think that's all I wanted to say for now. Thank you again.
Thank you. And currently there are no further there are no further comments at this time.
Having no further comments, I'll move to close the discussion on the LCD and turn the time over to Dr. Cunningham.
Thank you, Mark. I failed to mention at the beginning that Dr. Alladelli and Dr. McKinney are also with us. Did you have anything for the open meeting?
No, no, not from me. Thank you, Karen.
Anything else from those on the phone? Thank you all very much. The comment period goes to November 7th, 2020, and we welcome your comments. Thank you very much. Thank you, operator.
Thank you. That does conclude today's conference. Thank you all for participating. You may now disconnect.